Hello and welcome to the Fostering and Adoption Podcast with me, Al Coates, and Scott Casanrenny, who is still poorly and will be back as soon as possible. Today I'm releasing some audio from an evidence session that I gave to the Children and Families Act Committee at the House of Lords on Monday the 4th of April. I was invited to go along and discuss contemporary issues around adoption and some of the challenges that are being faced in relation to waiting times, around adoption support, around race disparity, contact. A whole raft of other things were brought up in the discussion. I was giving evidence with Naomi Angel, who's a consultant at Osborne's Law, and she spoke in relation to some of the legal issues that she is working with and perceives as someone who's kind of embedded in the field. It's the full session, and we were asked across an hour a whole raft of questions, and I hope you enjoy it. I hope you find it interesting. I certainly found it really, really thought-provoking. I was given the questions beforehand, so I knew pretty much what was coming, but again, it was really interesting to try and condense some of those questions and think, actually, what are the key issues? So I found it an amazingly useful observation. I want to thank everyone for their kind comments afterwards, and mostly my mother, who was over the moon, though deeply, deeply disappointed that I wore a check shirt and a red hat. So thanks very much, and we'll have more episodes soon, and a little update on Scott. Scott is continuing to recover. He's doing well. I'm going out to Ireland next week to see him and hopefully spend a bit of time with him, and he's on a long road to recovery, but he's doing much better day by day. Thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy listening.
Well, welcome everyone to this meeting of the Select Committee on the Children and Families Act 2014. I'd like to welcome both our committee members and our two witnesses. And just to note that this session is being broadcast online, and that a transcript will be taken and will be available after the meeting. I wondered if I might begin by asking both of our two witnesses, who are both extremely welcome, just to introduce yourself just very briefly. Al, can I...
Thank you.
And I gather you're happy to be addressed by your first name, yeah?
Yes, please.
Yep. Yeah. Great, Al.
Yep. I'm an adoptive parent to six children. I was previously a foster carer. I'm a registered manager and a qualified social worker for a small independent foster care agency. I was a former panel member for a local authority adoption team. I'm part of the Department for Education's Adopter Reference Group, and I'm a founder and host of the Adoption Podcast, and we get about 12,000 downloads, listeners, a month.
Thanks. Thank you very much. And Naomi?
I'm a children's lawyer. I've been doing this for a long time. I'm head of currently the Adoption Surrogacy and Fertility Law Department at Osborne's Law, which is a London law firm. I've got a history in child protection work and... For many years, and I'm now mainly specialising in adoption, surrogacy, and sort of cases, children's cases with an immigration interface, unaccompanied refugee children. I have advised, like everybody, so birth parents, adopters, adoptees, foster parents, local authorities. I've also chaired an adoption panel of a national adoption agency for several years, and I'm an adopter of three children who are very grown up now, and I'm on the Children's Law Subcommittee of the Law Society.
Well, thank you very much indeed. You're both very welcome. The committee has been looking at the whole issue of adoption now for about 3 weeks, and talking to a range of people who are involved, but we were particularly keen to have a session where we could hear from people who have got direct experience of the adoption system, either, you know, personally or through their work. So you know, we're very much looking forward to hearing from you. And I wondered if I could just kick off by just in very general terms by asking you both what you think the biggest sort of challenge or issues facing the adoption system at the moment is. And then Al, would you like to kick off?
Yeah, I think there's two primary issues that I think that are facing, and you can group them quite simply into How does the system or the agencies reflect the experience of those people who are living in it? And we think about 2/3 of people who are involved in adoption do so without consent. Birth parents and adoptive parents who I'm not sure whether they've had the opportunity to give evidence, but they are often misrepresented or don't have the opportunity. Adopted people, and I'm not going to pretend to speak on behalf of adopted people, but I can reflect what I know, is that they often feel that what they wanted and needed as children is very different to what they want and need as adolescents and to how they feel about adoption as adults, and they have no right of recourse to that. That they are, it's a fait accompli, it's done. Birth parents, I think, often feel, and birth families often feel that adoption is a system, is a punishment for not being able to care for their children. And we have, there's good reason often why parents can't look after children, but often there's whole communities around children, aunties, uncles, nieces, nephews, siblings, also are punished for their inability to care for those children. Mm-hmm. And that's a lifelong consequence. So that's one. Sorry, I'm... the second one, I think, is that we have a system that I don't necessarily think reflects the lifelong needs of families of adoptive parents. And again, what a 5-year-old needs is not what a 15-year-old needs, is not what an adult adopted person needs. And we have a system that is very front-loaded towards getting children into homes. It's very good at settling children in. But then we've got a whole raft of services that are not necessarily able to or willing to meet the needs of children. We have a statutory requirement for adoption needs to be assessed, but seems almost cruel that there's nothing after that. There's no actual right to have those needs met, which seems like a really complicated thing. And I think finally, I think there's this, what I see is there's a recruitment crisis because of this adoption support paradox. The idea that if you read the recruitment, it says we're going to give you wonderful recruitment, wonderful support, we're going to provide this, this and this. And then people coming to adoption think, well, why do I need that? If you're telling me all is well in adoption, why do I need that level of support? And if you're saying I need that level of support, then perhaps my potential for a, you know, inverted commas, normal family life is not, you know, it's not possible. And so it undermines the recruitment message. So there's this paradox. And I think that the needs of children who are being adopted now are probably the most severe of all, of most children in society. They're immeasurably vulnerable. For example, 65% of children or families experience violent, aggressive behaviour from children who are responding to early life experience. So those are the two issues.
Well, thank you. I mean, you know, there's an awful lot there for us to think about. That's really helpful. Could I just ask, you know, when you're doing your podcasts, what are the most common issues that come up from your, both from your sort of guests and your listeners? Are they the ones that you've just summarised there? Or
I would hope so, because otherwise they'll come and get me. No, I think that, yes, that the continuity of support is a key issue, and that we have we have adopted people come on, we have birth families, we have adopters come on. And the lack of support, the issues around choice about, you know, what adopted adults want is so often overlooked by society. You know, we want the cute story. Politicians want to have the photograph taken next to them as adoptive parents, but nobody wants the adopted 35-year-old story. People love their children dearly. Very few people wouldn't not do it again. But a lot of people would do it differently, and they would fight for support, because the power imbalance at the very beginning of the process is, you're giving us children, we will do as we're told, we'll be good adopters, only to discover that the die is cast, the adoption order is made, and there's no recourse. Mm. And families would fight harder and longer and probably delay adoption orders to get the appropriate support for their children.
Thank you very much indeed. I say there's a lot there. I'm sure we'll want to sort of pick up on a number of the issues you've just raised. No, it's very helpful. So, Naomi, could I sort of just turn to you and ask you what you feel the greatest challenges or the big issues facing the system are at the moment?
I think probably quite a lot of what I'm going to say, as a lawyer, is going to resonate with what Al's saying. It's absolutely central for me is adoption support and the lack of it.
Yeah.
And I see families with their children, often teenagers, who are really challenging. And they need support desperately. And they have to fight every step of the way when actually their energy should be given to bringing up these really challenging teenagers. And it's often only at the point of breakdown that they get that support. and it's too late by then. Mm. And the absolute worst thing for these children who've had so many losses in their lives already is the breakdown of their adoptive placement. So I know there's the Adoption Support Fund, but again, that's not an easy journey for people. Mm. And, you know, I've got a family at the moment who've been fighting for 5 years with two incredibly disabled children. And they know what these children need, but they're not listened to. Mm. And they've had to fight and fight and fight. And finally, actually, one of these fights started in 2013, and it's not fair. It's really not fair. And then what the risk is then, that they're such troublemakers, or seen as troublemakers, that their ability to parent these children is then questioned as to whether they've got adequate parenting skills. And that, if anything's going to make me really angry, that's probably it.
Could you say how in practice that assessment of parenting skills and whether they are, you know, adequate is made?
Right in the beginning, yeah. When they're being assessed as their suitability.
Yeah.
Well, it's pretty robust. I mean, if you... it's pretty robust, and prospective adopters complain about its robustness. It's quite intrusive. They have to talk about a lot of very personal stuff. But I always treat it like a risk assessment. And basically, it's not about children for families, it's about families for children. And you have to look at all the areas of potential risk. You're looking at... if you have a good social work relationship, it can be a really educative experience too. Because how many parents actually have the chance to look ahead? Mm. And how are they going to deal with sort of challenging behaviour, racism, if their child ends up coming out as gay? You don't have any opportunities for that. And a good assessment will look at all of that. And they'll look at contact, particularly now. That's very important because access to information for children is changing so dramatically with the social media. Children can find their parents very often,
yes.
And parents can find their children. And the assessment has to take that into account. A good assessment, I mean, I know that people say it's too intrusive, but I think that it has to be. Although, it has to be within reason. But I think it's got better.
Thank you very much indeed. As I say, there's a lot there I'm sure we're going to want to pick up on. And I know some of my colleagues would like to come in and ask you various questions now. So could I invite Baroness Blower to ask the next question, Christine?
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much for being with us today. So the question that I want to ask is, why are the numbers of early permanence placements so low? We've done a bit of work, so we know about early permanence, fostering to adopt, and the concurrent planning. So you don't need to tell us that, but we want to know why they're so low, and what could be done to encourage and support early placements. And or, perhaps you don't think we do need to encourage early placements, but we've got the kind of impression that one of the advantages of fostering to adopt is that the child would then have fewer moves, clearly.
It's win-win for the child.
Yeah.
They don't have to move. They can form their early attachments. But I'm more concerned that it should be the right placements and that there shouldn't be... Well, I think one of the other things I'd say in things which have got to change is that I really do not like blanket policies. Each case has to be considered on its facts, and as soon as you get an ideology coming in, the risk is it doesn't. So with adoption, it's a very special sort of adoption. I mean, I know when I see clients who've got to the end of fertility treatment, they've drawn a line in the sand there, and they see me and we go through all the options for them. And that could be adoption, it could be international adoption, surrogacy. But with domestic adoption, we'll talk about early permanence. But it is a special family who can deal with that. They have to accept the uncertainty and the risk that they'll have to hand that child back and whether they can actually do it. So I would hate to see the wrong families being pushed into it. But there's so many advantages of it. I think one I've seen is that because these foster to adopt have to commit to a pretty heavy period of contact, while it's being decided by the courts whether the birth parents can, in fact, parent these children in an extended family, they get to know the birth parents, and that's got huge advantages. And I think, I mean, I haven't got the statistics at my... I'm not an academic and I'm not a statistician, but my understanding is that you're much less likely to get oppositions, heavy oppositions to adopt, to care orders and adoption, if the families have got to know each other and the parents can reflect and see that maybe they can't parent that child now, but they get an insight into what it might be for the next child.
Thanks. Al, do you want to add something? I may want to come back, but let's hear from Al.
I think one thing that part of that dynamic is that I think generally across the social care workforce, there's questions about adoption. And I think the early permanence is there's an element of risk, and it's not a mathematical risk, it's very human risk. I think BASWA's 2017 report into social workers and adoption saw that there was lots of questions amongst the workforce, and I think that the acknowledgement of the finality of adoption for children and families meant that there was a caution, and I think an appropriate caution, but we don't often hear from social workers. We hear from a lot from managers, and we hear from a lot, you know, leaders of organisations. My talking to a lot of families and seeing what they're saying is that risk feels like a big roll of the dice, because no one can guarantee, and if you've got your own children as well, or you've got older adopted children in the family, it's a big risk. I'm not sure I would take it.
Sorry, can I just follow up a second? So does that mean that in the case of fostering to adopt, there wouldn't have been the kind of robust process that you talked about, Naomi?
No, they certainly will be, because they're assessed as fosterers as well as adopters. Mm. So, and it has to be more rigorous in a way, because, you know, these people have got to accept the uncertainty and whether they can commit to that child hook, line and sinker, even though they might not... they might end up having to hand the child back. I think what it also needs is very careful selection of the cases that go into foster to adopt, so that everybody isn't set up to fail. So it really depends, again, on the quality of the social work and the quality of the assessment.
Can I just say, so is your conclusion from that, then, the fact that there are very low numbers in early permanence is not a failure of the system? It's actually that...
I don't know.
It's a difficult place to be.
I'm not sure about the statistics. And I'm a supporter of it. But I, you know, I see the sort of casework end of it. It would be somebody like Coram Bath, who would actually have the actual information from research as well. I mean, they provide an absolutely excellent programme. I mean, they're, you know, they're the Rolls Royce of early permanency.
Al, do you want to say anything else?
No, I just think it's very difficult to measure, isn't it? Because also with that, the quality of the early intervention with the family prior to that plan, also it can depend on the whole dynamics around the family. So it might be an aunt, an uncle, a grandparent who may step in, and the child returns to the family, not necessarily to the parents. So there's so many moving parts. I think it's hard to say there should be more or should be less. It's...
Okay, thank you very much. Very helpful.
May I just ask a very quick supplementary out of something you said, where you sort of indicated that, you know, there was some scepticism in parts of the social work profession as whether it was, you know, the right adoption was the right option for certain children. Do you think that explains the reasons why the numbers have been going down, the numbers of adoptions?
Not wholly, I think, but I think it's part... I think there's a whole range of influences to why adoptions are lowering, but I think that children and family social workers are the first rung of the adoption ladder, and often they're not necessarily party to these conversations or debates. They're often... we talk to adoption services, not early family services.
Yeah. Okay, no, thank you very much. Sorry, did you just come in, Naomi?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, one has to drill down on why the numbers have dropped. And I think I come down again to blanket policies. There's a huge rise in special guardianship orders, and adoptions are dropping. They're very, very separate things, special guardianship and adoption. And it's a question of, again, looking at each case and deciding what's right for that child. I think there's also been the, it's cases of Re-B and Re-BS, which I'm sure people have talked to you about already. I think there was a misinterpretation of that, and the president of the family decision has said that. I mean, what I understood that it should mean is that it's got to be a real proper analysis of the pros and cons of all the different options for that child. You can't, it's just the way that you think about it. There has to be a proper analysis. And then it's a level playground of really looking at what's right for that child. Mm. And just rushing loads of cases into special guardianship, it may be that there's extended family members for whom adoption would be the right order rather than special guardianship, just because they're relatives. It's, you know, there are cases, and I've had them. And I just fear blanket policies. And that is, I've seen that happen in social work for many years.
Thank you very much. Baroness Prussian.
Thank you very much indeed. Hello, Ellen. Hello, Naomi. Yeah. My question is about the 26-week time frame. And what do you think has been the impact of that time limit on care and placement proceedings? And what have been the main sort of barriers and challenges to achieving that particular time frame?
I think it's mixed again. I'd certainly think that it's challenged drift. I've seen terrible drifting cases where they just sort of go on and on and on. And I think that has certainly been a very, very good side of it. But it has got difficulties inherently. Family members often stand back when birth parents are being assessed because they don't want to interfere and they don't want to think that they're not supporting the birth parents. So they can actually step forward really quite late in the process. And if you're going to fix too rigidly to the 26-week period, it's going to mean there's the risk of very hasty assessments of special guardians, which is, it's not like adoption. It happens much more quickly. Somehow, because they're related, it's not as thorough. And actually, these are just the same children who are being adopted. And the needs, I think they're more complicated, the cases, because they're having, they're embedded within the birth family from which these children, who've not been found to be able to parent these children. And then there's going to be continued contact within the birth family, the extent to which those relatives can protect the children, if needs be. And I think in many ways it needs... Well, I think all assessments should be thorough, but I think that that definitely is one of the dangers. And the other thing which I've seen is, in my casework, I've seen many more cases where birth parents have... Sorry, that was just terrible. I thought I'd turned it off. Sorry. Many more parents now are applying for leave to oppose adoption proceedings. And I think this is because the 26 weeks and the rush of it has often not given them the opportunity to reflect and to accept why maybe now they're not able to parent this child. Maybe now isn't the right point of their life when they can do it. And I think we've just had so many more applications by birth parents for leave to adopt, and that is really tough for the adopters. Often they haven't been warned of this possibility by the social workers, so it comes as a complete surprise to them, and it's incredibly stressful. And then they have real problems with legal aid, because they're not going to be eligible for legal aid with the eligibility levels, and so they're dependent on whether the local authorities will fund them, and local authorities are very resistant to that. My experience, I've had cases where they funded all the way through, but majority of them, the local authorities say they'll fund 2 hours of advice. And that is completely inadequate to be able to take the full story of a very complex situation and then advise them, look at all the documents. It's utterly inadequate, and it means these people are not getting proper advice.
Thank you.
What's your experience?
I don't feel particularly qualified to speak of that. The only thing I would comment is, working in the social care system generally, is that seeing the lack of resources, high staff turnover, and all of that I think impacts on just general casework, which consequently will impact on the 26 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I know there's an emphasis for the 26 weeks, but to my mind it's number of moves for children as opposed to time frames. Those moves are much more challenging, it's an adversity for children. So nothing.
Do you think, Naomi, it's unrealistic to have a time frame, or are you looking for more flexibility? What would you recommend?
I think it's there, the flexibility. It's right for some cases. They're straightforward, and you can do it. But there is this ability to extend it sort of every, I think, 8 weeks. And that should give the flexibility. But I know that there are judges who it's a sort of badge of honour that they keep within the 26 weeks. And obviously, again, it's blanket policies, which I feel very uncomfortable with. So I think it's not a it's not a simple answer to that. It's definitely been some values in it. It's definitely also been some values, and you don't get too many experts because you have to justify the need for an expert. It has to be necessary. You have to prove that to the court. And I think that definitely is, as you know, I've seen that being very positive because the cases get more and more complicated. And the only other thing I think about the 26-week rule is that the cases, in my experience, are getting more and more complex. And, you know, you can't force them into a straitjacket. The important thing is that the right decision's made. These are real human rights situations where the most serious decisions that can face somebody is whether they lose their child or not.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Baroness Massey is participating virtually, so I'm now going to invite Baroness Massey to ask her question. Doreen.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you. And welcome to our guests. I want to ask you about the information that adopters and adopted people have the right to get to support them. As I understand it, the Adoption Support Fund is for therapeutic support. And it seems to me that people may need more other support other than purely therapeutic support. And we had a witness last session who talked about this, and she said, this group doesn't know where to go or how to get support and what's available. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on how this could be improved. Particularly, I want to ask you, is there a regular place for people being adopters and adopted, being asked and consulted on what is best for them?
That's quite a complicated question. I think that in general, adoption support services through the regional adoption agencies are okay. And I think they know what they're talking about. There may be challenges in relation to timescales and quality of that work. But that is only one piece of an adopted child's life, that a child will need support through medical services, mental health services, school services, specialist services such as life story work, which is therapeutic. And I think what so many families find is that they are having to fight at every juncture to get support, effective support and meaningful support. We see, you know, large numbers of children trying to get education healthcare plans, and just it being a constant fight for the parents. Just regular support in children, you know, blanket rules around how children are supported within schools. So I think that parents find themselves adrift from what their original plan for adoption was. They find themselves out of step and in a very difficult situation. And I don't think there is one central point. I think if you know, the RAAs, the regional adoption agencies, have I think within the last few weeks or months, have just all the local authorities have come together. But that's caused a huge flux in the system as well. People losing touch with their historic services, or, you know, them being amalgamated into larger agencies, losing touch with their personal, that lifelong support. You know, I've had social workers in my... I'm fortunate I've had a social worker for 10 years. But that's because I'm stroppy and loud and gobby. But some people just don't get that. They're on to their third and fourth and fifth. So if you get an email, you might get an email from a local authority telling you what support you're entitled to. You might not. So I think families find themselves catastrophically adrift, not knowing what support they're entitled to, how to get that support. Even simple things like how to get an ECHP plan, how to get access to CAMHS, you know, all of the things that we would hope the most vulnerable children in our community would have access to, parents find themselves fighting for.
But if this is known, that it is chaotic, what do you think can be done to improve the situation?
That is a really good question. I think that there needs to be, in some ways, I think that regional adoption agencies or social workers should become like case managers. There should be take a role of supporting a team around children, that is ongoing and lifelong, that it isn't just that social workers dip in and dip out, that actually there's a continuity across a child's lifetime from, you know, the day they're adopted right through till they're 18 and maybe 21, depending on their needs, 21, 25. Someone who can coordinate those services, you know, safeguarding. Adoptive parents often find themselves dragged back into safeguarding concerns through different agencies because of a whole raft of vulnerabilities of children. With services not aware of children's adopted status or the specific vulnerabilities and nuances of adoption and how that can impact on their children's behaviour and their worldview of themselves and the people around them.
Naomi, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what Al said resonates for me, but certainly in the middle of these disrupted or potentially disruptive adoption placements, you find adopters who actually haven't been given sufficient information about the child. You know, it sort of trickles out when maybe there's sexualized behavior within the adopted family, that there was a potential history of sexual abuse and that the adopters just were completely unaware of this. And it trickles out in the wrong way and at the wrong time when there's, you know, you're facing a potential breakdown. And I think I think that there's a move towards sibling placements, and I think that social workers are often over-optimistic and not totally realistic about how big an ask that is. A family that I've been dealing with recently, it was three children were placed with them, and it's just disrupted for the eldest one. They've had to put that eldest child back into care because actually that child should have been in a one-to-one placement right from the start. But they didn't look at it, they didn't really drill down on needs of each of those children.
May I just pursue that point? Then I know that Baroness Blower wants to, because you do hear and read so much about the impact of siblings being split up when they go into care or are adopted, and all sorts of problems that causes. So how do you balance that with the issues that you've just raised?
That's a very good question. It is a balance in the end, yeah. But I don't think you can underestimate the challenges of sibling placement. When all those children, quite often they've come from families where there may be two or three different fathers, really complicated families, and those children have had totally different lived experiences. So yes, it's really important to get children together if you possibly can, but that mustn't overshadow when actually it just might not be realistic. If it's going to lead to a risk of breakdown. I mean, I had one case where three children, first-time parents, I think for first-time parents as well, it's a very big ask. And the middle child, really displayed really difficult behaviour. And it was really impacting on the care of the other two children. But they hadn't got adoption orders yet, and the local authority removed all three children, which was really sad.
Thank you very much. Baroness Blower.
Thank you. If I could go back to something that you said earlier, Naomi, that you were dealing with a case, obviously not, I don't want to know the details of the case, but since 2013. So my question is, why would something take as long as that? And the second question that arises from that is that getting any education healthcare plan is actually quite difficult for anybody under some circumstances, let alone with the additional question of, adoption. And that's very often, frankly, down to funding. So is this ongoing since 2013 down to funding in part, and is the difficulty that adoptive parents face in navigating the support question down to funding, as well as the other kind of, what Doreen Massey described as chaos?
I think that certainly funding is a large chunk of it, but this case, which has been going on since 2013 and which you still haven't finished, so much money has been put into the wrangles between the RAAs, the social... I mean, this case is two local authorities, one where the children live, one where they're in care, one where they now live, two different RAAs. I find it incredibly difficult to sort of work out what responsibilities have gotten. There's been legal intervention for ages, and if one just added up the money that had cost it, what these family wanted was very straightforward and simple. And they weren't listened to, and they weren't respected for the fact that they knew what those children needed. And the social workers, social workers have changed so many times, you couldn't imagine. Big files, who goes back through trawls back through a really big file, they find themselves arguing the same issues over and over again with different people.
That does sound very confusing. Al?
Yeah, I mean, I think funding, you can't remove funding from the conversation. Last week someone told me they were told it would be a 5-month wait before they had an assessment of their child's needs. And then... the needs are immediate. I have a friend whose child attempted suicide, a viable attempt at suicide, and they were put on an emergency referral to CAMHS 6 months. And that's an emergency referral. And so you can't remove the context of finances, and that then plays into staff. Staff are impacted by that and move on, looking for better wages, I guess.
Right, thank you. Thank you very much indeed for that. If we move on now to Baroness Lawrence. Dorry.
Hi, thank you both for being here. Listening to all the discussion going on about between 2013, that must be quite traumatic for the children or for the child within that, waiting all this time for an assessment and for a decision to be made. But that's not really my question. It's just, listening to that, it must be very traumatic for the family and for the child in those settings. And I think at the end of the day, who's winning in all of that? Not the child, and certainly not the adopters either.
No.
And I think those are sort of needs that need to be taken into consideration when social workers and whoever it is going and to-ing and fro-ing, because it's not benefiting those who need to be benefited from it. So, so that's not my question. My question is around legislation. Is that what changes are needed to modernise the improvement of post-adoption contact? Do these changes require new legislation, would you say? Can we start with you, Naomi?
I think it's not so much about legislation, because I think orders made for contact are not appropriate. They take a snapshot of a point in time, and it's hard to force an order on adopters who really don't want that rigidity, because a child's needs at 2 for contact is going to be very different from a child's needs at 13. So I think what it does need is very good assessment. Again, it needs quality of assessment of adopters, so that they really discuss the issue of contact. Realistically, when now there's sort of social media and the ability for people to make contact with each other, that is realistic and it has to be tackled, and how they will deal with it, because the adopters may not know what their children are doing at all. I know that Section 51A has brought in the right to apply for leave for post-adoption contact. In my mind, that actually hasn't made that much difference, and it doesn't seem a particularly worthwhile piece of legislation. Contact is really important. Sibling contact is really important. Letterbox contact is, but the families don't get a lot of help, either the birth families or the adopters, with letterbox contact to make it meaningful, or how they should go about it and what the expectations are. And if there's going to be direct contact, I've seen it where they're going to get social work support for 6 months. They need to walk the journey all the way along, because what they have to guard against is birth parents who may not have accepted the adoption, and the risk of undermining it. And there needs really skilled social work to be able to manage and navigate the families, both sides of it, through that.
I think that contact is the issue that will define whether adoption is still with us in 20 or 30 years, if I'm frank. I think that it's the most talked about issue in all of the social media circles. When we put podcasts out about contact, they're the ones that are listened to the most, people comment on the most. And I think we've got a system that currently was developed in the 1950s and before computers were even discovered. We're asking people to write letters. I don't know about you, but I don't write letters. And we're asking vulnerable people to write letters. We're asking adult adoptive parents to write letters. We live in a social media age, and yet our feet are firmly stuck in the last century. And we need a flexible, intuitive, meaningful, risk-averse, but appropriately safe system that allows for meaningful support for lifelong contact with safe members of birth families. Recently, I was given information from a Freedom of Information request across all the RAAs across the UK, and it's amazing the amount of birth parents who are writing to adopters. It's in the numbers of hundreds, and are not getting responses from adoptive parents. Once the adoption order is made, adopters do what they want. And the needs of five-year-olds are very different to the needs of 10-year-olds. And when children become adolescents, 20 years ago, you'd have to go to the library and look through a microfiche and find someone, you know, if you can remember what microfiches are. But now you give me 3 minutes with a mobile phone and I can find you. And we need to have a flexible approach, and we need to find an antidote to what is, you know, we've all been angry teenagers and acted impulsively. And we find lots of families really struggling to support their children. We've got a system that works on the worst case scenario that presumes that all the birth parents are dangerous and unsafe. And I think we need to kind of pull practice, because I think the legislation's got enough flex in it, but we need to pull practice into a very responsive, individualised and reviewed process. So we're not just saying, you know, my daughter at, you know, she was 2 years old, we decided that we would write a letter once a year. She's now 10. And we've tried to reinitiate contact with family, and it's really, really hard because the trail has gone dead. People are not around anymore. And actually, we want to find a flexible approach, but that's all off my initiation. We need, you know, do we need social workers who come and review, an annual review, and say, well, what are your needs? What are your contact needs? Adopters held to account, but birth families as well. Well, you said you were going to do this, and why aren't you doing this? So that when children are young adults, that maybe actually at 15, 16, then physical contact is appropriate. Because we know that the physical risks that were for a 3-year-old are not present for a 15-year-old or an 18 or a 22-year-old. And that those relationships cannot be restored. You can't get time back. But if we can keep a thread going through, then let's do it with ongoing reviews. Sorry.
As you were speaking, you talk about like social media, which we know that most teenagers are on social media, mm-hmm. so they can track their birth parents. So if you were to sort of recommendation around the legislation that you think that may need to change in order to adapt to the modernisation of social media and contact, what would you say that would you would sort of pass on to the powers that be then to say this is what we thought from your experience?
I'd like to think that there would be a presumption of contact. I think I'd like to shift it, because at the moment there's a presumption of letterbox. There needs to be a presumption of contact unless there's a good reason not to, whereas at the moment it's a presumption of letterbox and you have to prove why you need to speak to people. I think we need to just reframe that and hold adopters, you know, we can't hold adopters account because once the adoption order is made, we can't, but I think people will lose their children. And I think that there are, you know, there's some really good stuff coming out of the RAAs with Sarah Johal, and, you know, they're looking at digital means of doing it, which I think is going to be much more, you know, really good. But it's like you said, no blanket rules.
Yeah, I mean, which is what I'm worried about. Again, with you saying a presumption of contact, I could see sort of blanket rules sort of seeping in again. I think with baby adoptions, yeah, there's this... the natural thing is letterbox contact only. You can't do that for a 10-year-old who's had his lived experience, has been, you know, he's got all the contacts with his broader family. And that has to be enveloped by it all. And I think the reality of no contact for a child like that is not very realistic at all and not what the child needs. There's another aspect to it of life story work, which is absolutely crucial, that the children get a realistic picture of why their parents were not able to parent them and why they had to be placed permanently elsewhere. That it's not just, they didn't love you. They loved you so much that they felt you could be looked after. You know, they couldn't give you all you wanted. It has to go a lot deeper than that. And the more information that you can get from birth parents and birth families for life story work, that is incredibly important. And I think that families, that's a continuing dialogue as well. It's not just a conversation that you have with a 2-year-old explaining how mother ducks have baby ducks. It's about, you know, it's a continuing dialogue, and you've got to keep that conversation going. And I think that is probably the best way, that is having that continuing communication with your child, that you will best equip them to be able to deal with some of the risks of social media and ensure that it's a, you know, that you're, it's something that you do together as a team.
Right, so next question, Lord Brownlow, David.
How can we address the racial and ethnic disparities in the adoption system? And do you have a view as to what support is needed to help families adopting children of a different race?
I mean, I think the first thing I'd like to point out is we don't know how many children are being adopted by parents of a different race or ethnicity. That data is not collected, and the answer is always, well, what do we do with that data? But I think if we're bothered about it, we measure it. We measure what matters. I'd respectfully suggest that I've looked across all of the people who've given evidence, and every one of them's been white, to my knowledge. So I'm cautious about speaking outside of my experience. But listening to people of different cultures and ethnicity, the adoption system is predominantly led by white individuals. Of the 32 RAAs, every single one of them is white. The leader is white, sorry. And there's one voluntary agency which has got an Asian head of service. On a workforce level, if you go to the metropolitan, if you go to London, you'll see the workforce reflects the community that it's serving. If you step outside of London, Manchester, Birmingham, it's a predominantly all-white workforce. And I think that there's, you know, again, I'm being careful what I say, I'm on thin ice, but people are nervous around social services. You know, you don't flag up yourself to social services willingly. You know, we know people of different cultures and ethnicities have had pretty poor service at best. And I think all of that then plays into why people of a different ethnicity don't come forwards. Also, there's other cultural reasons around that, of how families are constituted and what are culturally norms. You know, I think adoption is a particularly Anglo-Saxon kind of route. You know, it's part of our faith narrative as well. I am a transracial adopter, so I feel like I can speak with a level of insight into that. But actually, I don't think we prepare people to be transracial adopters. We approve them as adopters. Mm. But then what inevitably happens, especially at the moment when there are less children than there are adopters, adopters wait on the shelf, and eventually the children who are hard to place, which inevitably are children of colour, you know, we know that the children, you know all the statistics, and then families are then asked to take children that they wouldn't necessarily be their first choice. And at that point, we then, have they been assessed to care for children of a different ethnicity? Because it is different. It's not the same. It can't be the same, and we should never think it is the same. And I think that removing the clause was a misstep. And I think we've got to go. I don't believe in that, like, you know, I'm sure Naomi's going to say, but I don't think there's blanket rules, but we need to take it on a case-by-case basis. We need to assess families and their capacity to care for children by a workforce that's informed by that. You know, a white social worker asked me about how I'm going to look after my black adopted child. Mm. Well, neither of us knew what we were talking about. Mm. I'll be frank.
Naomi?
I actually do support the removing of the section on giving a separate section on giving due consideration to race, culture, and religion. I mean, I feel that from my practice, it meant that that aspect of a child's needs was treated as a trump card, when it's an incredibly important factor, but it's to be considered in the context of all the other factors as well, in looking for the best family for that particular child. And I think that even with that having been repealed, it's sufficiently encompassed by the welfare checklist in the Adoption and Children Act, which there's one specific section on the needs of the child in relation to its particular characteristics. And I suppose it's blanket policies, it comes down to me again, is that being the trump card, I think, meant that, I'm not a statistician, as I said, but I think it did result in more children of colour being stuck in the care system. And the longer you're stuck in the care system, there's going to be moves in foster homes, that these children become unadoptable because they've accumulated so many difficulties. So there definitely are insufficient foster carers of colour being, approved. And I don't know what that is. I don't know the extent to which the agencies reach out for a much more diverse group of adopters. The assessment process, as I said, I think it's pretty robust. And if it doesn't include, if it's a transracial placement, if it doesn't include a large chunk of it being as to how that they would support that child in the ethnic racial differences, then it's failed. And then the families I've seen have gone to enormous lengths to be able to give their child knowledge and pride in their heritage, even though they have to accept that there are, that there are differences. And if you could, place a child within their own the ethnic group, then that would be better. But you can't wait. These children can't wait. And if you look at the population of London, of how diverse it is, you're never going to be able to make a perfect match on that basis for a child. You have to look at it globally and holistically.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. If there are no other supplementary questions on that point, then could I invite Lord Cruddas then to ask the final question, please?
Sure, but before I do, I want to say that I found your evidence and experiences today very powerful, depressing, but really you know what you're talking about. No, well, that's why we're here, but I've really enjoyed your evidence and the stuff you've told us today, so thank you for that. So I guess my question's probably the simplest one. What one change would you like to see in the adoption system? But also, do you think that policymakers, courts and local authorities sufficiently consult and take account of the views of people with lived experiences?
I'll start
with a thank you for your evidence.
Oh, thank you. It's okay.
It's very, very good. Very good.
I think that, which links back to my first point, which I think that the system struggles to take the views. I think it welcomes the views of adoptive parents. I think that we have a cultural narrative around adoption, which is that it's a good thing. And so as an adoptive parent, there's a canonisation. And people see you as universally as a good person for doing that. However, I don't see that the voices of adopted adults or adopted children are welcomed to the same extent, because often their views may be different. They may not, especially if those views are, they don't align with, if they're not happy with adoption. So that we have no mechanism and we don't have I don't see those voices at a policy level, how that's worked out. There's green shoots, so there is cause for optimism, but I think we've got a way to come. Only now in 2022 we're starting to see that. I think birth parents are, there's an expectation that they just go away and be quiet. You've made your bed, lie in it. And I think that's the reality. There's good organisations like PAWS, Families in Care, but they're voices that are really hard to collect because they're often people who've been made more vulnerable by the adoption. The experience of losing a child, regardless of why you've lost a child, I can't begin to comprehend the how catastrophic that is. One legislative change.
I'm going to be really boring because it's going to be the blanket policies, which has always ideology has always terrified me. I look at my caseload. There's not one case I could say which is the same as any other case. It's the things that Alan and I have both been saying about the absolutely cornerstone importance of adoption support for all the players in the system. That's absolutely everybody. And it's difficult to reach out to children, to young people, when there's consultations and what have you. But there have to be imaginative ways of doing it because their views are the lived experience. And you can't ignore that if you're going to have effective legislation and guidance and procedures.
Yeah. Can I just ask one other question? I suppose it's quite natural to assume that the best thing for children is to keep siblings together. But in reality, is that the case?
I think that it, again...
Yeah.
I think it depends on the individual case, again, right. Which is what I've been saying. Yes, I think if at all possible, siblings should be kept together because those are the lasting relations. Those are the ones which go way beyond the lives of their adopters, foster carers, birth parents, and they are absolutely crucial. And one has to look at sibling contact very seriously, but it's not right for every single case.
You gave an example earlier where you had three children and the middle one was disrupted. And I assume they were in a good.
They had extra needs. They were never going to be met within that particular family and with the whole group of children, because these were first time parents. You remember yourself as first time parents. Yeah. You do your best, even if you've been massively trained. So it's a big ask.
I think as well that there's a very common narrative of a child who stays in his biological home and. They experience the worst of life and within that context, and they may be removed as a toddler and maybe another baby's on the way and they're siblings, but one child has experienced high levels of adversity across all of the board, another child's maybe been removed straight into care. Their needs are palpably different and so contrasting. Sometimes families just struggle to meet both needs, with one child who needs a very specific type of parenting, a care and therapeutic environment, and another child who needs something different. It's an enormously emotive subject. You can see it, you know, Adoption Week rolls around and there's two faces of two little cherubs and our hearts go out. But I think it's got to be a case by case. We've got to have clear thinking and remove sentimentality from those conversations.
May I just follow up, Naomi, just with one final point, because you've made a big point about, you know, your dislike of blanket policies and how each case is individual, and I fully understand that. But if we moved away from a system that did have fairly sort of clear set of rules and systems, how would you deal with the issue of sort of inconsistency, of favouritism, of sort of undue discretion, or people claiming unfair treatment if we went much more in the direction that you seem to be advocating?
Difficult question.
So it's another of these balancing acts.
Yeah, it is a balancing act. I'm not sure it's about law. I think law is quite a blunt instrument to actually deal with these very human situations. And I think it's down to the quality of relationships, the support for those relationships, because that's sort of key to how it all works.
Right. Thank you very much indeed. Mm-hmm. And we're virtually out of time, but were there any final points you were very keen to make that you haven't had an opportunity to make? Al?
No, I just thank you very much for the opportunity. And if you had more time, I'd encourage you to have the voices of adopted adults and children and people of different ethnicity and races, because they can speak exactly of their own experience.
I just want to say thank you. You've really given us the opportunity to air a lot of the issues that, you know, I've seen from my casework really need to be aired and to be addressed. So thank you.
As you can probably tell, I think we've all got an awful lot out of this session.
Mm.
It's been invaluable to us. And we are very actively looking at how we're going to be engaging with more people, Al, as you say, with lived experience from different sort of backgrounds and things. So it's very much, you know, it's high on our agenda, but thank you for making that point. So could I thank you both for your time and for sharing your sort of experiences and expertise with us. It's been excellent, so thank you very much indeed. And I now the session is now suspended.